from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Once, casino meant bonanza. Build a flashy gambling hall, attract visitors from all over, rake in state revenues. Now, as more and more states, 39 now, have more and more casinos, it can look like a grinding arms race for each state to hold on to its own gamblers, even its poorest gamblers, and revenues widely down. This hour On Point, we're looking again at the casino gamble. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's your experience with casinos in your state, your community? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Having this conversation today as one state, where I'm sitting right now, Massachusetts, highest court has this morning cleared the way for a repeal of state casino law that was to welcome casinos in. It'll be on the November ballot now, unanimous decision by the Supreme Judicial Court in Massachusetts saying bring on the referendum, let the public decide. Joining me now from Washington is Vin Narayanan, managing editor of the Casino City Times. Vin Narayanan, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure to be back.
And with us from Charleston, South Carolina, Doug Walker, professor of economics at the College of Charleston, expert on the economic and social effects of casino gambling. His latest book is Casinonomics, the Socioeconomics Impact of the Casino Industry. Doug Walker, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Vin, let me come first to you on this latest decision in the national casino conversation. Massachusetts High Court clearing the way for a referendum in November on whether this state will continue to pursue casinos. I can only imagine this will be a big fight, Vin, that there'll be plenty of money piling in trying to influence this one way or the other. Casino operators want more casinos.
Casino operators want more casinos, and they want into the Massachusetts market because it's a very, very big market. But this is more a referendum on just how poorly the process has gone in Massachusetts. This has gone on 2-3 years now where after the passage of legislation, they've been trying to get licenses issued and approved and the Gaming Commission up and running. And it's taken so long that the voters have turned on it, and it's pretty understandable.
This fits into a picture that people are talking about, a pinch, the boom being pinched, especially in northeastern states, but over a wide swath. Doug Walker, I'm looking here at the Wall Street Journal just in the last week saying that revenues are not coming in as they once did. States that adopted gambling earlier than their neighbors, like Delaware, New Jersey, West Virginia, now watching dollars drain away, revenues falling short of expectations. What's going on, Doug?
Well, the industry is certainly getting more competitive as it's spreading to newer states. The amount of money that consumers are willing to spend isn't necessarily rising as fast as the number of casinos is. So it's same amount of consumer spending or slightly increasing and a much bigger increase in supply.
The Wall Street Journal here looking at a pinch in the Northeast, in particular, 24 casinos within 100 miles of Philadelphia now. That sounds like a lot of supply. But they're also looking at, they said similar market shakeouts are occurring in Indiana and Mississippi on smaller scales. Pennsylvania, which roared out of nowhere since 2006 to become the state with the second most gambling revenue, has seen those revenues down in part because of competition from Maryland and Ohio. Regionally, Doug, where do you see the pinch to the extent that it's biting most seriously?
Well, I think in the Northeast is the most interesting region because that's where the expansion has been the greatest recently. And, of course, you have the largest concentration of the population up there. And so states that had casinos earlier on are now seeing a lot more competition. As you mentioned, Delaware, I think the tribal casinos in Connecticut have been seeing declining revenues recently. And so it's really, I think, the Northeast is the most interesting case where you can kind of see this happening.
Vin, what's going on here? Casino operators are still fighting tooth and nail to bring in new casinos, but then, I mean, I'm looking at news just in the last week again out of Atlantic City, the Revel Casino Hotel, $2.4 billion casino that was hailed as a revival of the city's gambling industry, opened just 2 years ago, now filing for bankruptcy. I look in Mississippi, and they're talking about the Tunica Miracle down there when gambling first came. And now I'm reading here, you know, a boom has slid into a struggle for survival. What's going on, Vin?
Yeah, what's going on is casinos aren't really good at competition. and which is weird because that's the American way. Businesses compete, states compete. Casinos aren't very good at competing with each other, and they aren't really good at competing for customers. They're really good at taking their customer database and maximizing the value of their customer database, but they're not really good at acquiring new customers. And what's happened is you're in a new paradigm. You're in a new business paradigm right now where you have casinos all over the place. And so how do you acquire new customers? How do you attract them? How do you retain them? How do you maximize that value? One of the interesting things that's going on is if you go back to 2005, New Jersey and Atlantic City was a $5 billion gaming market. Now you're in 2014, and if you take a look at Pennsylvania and Delaware and Maryland and New Jersey, all of that combined, you're almost at about $9 billion, between $8 and $9 billion market. So the market has grown, but the money's being redistributed, and that's the key. And so is there saturation? That depends on who you ask. If you ask Maryland Live, before Maryland Live was built, there wasn't saturation because they wanted to get built and get their piece of the market. And they brought in around, $586 million last year. But if you ask them now whether there's saturation, so they'll say yes, because they don't want the competition being built at National Harbor by MGM. So is there saturation? A lot of it really depends on who you ask.
Ask Fitch Ratings, their gaming analyst there, Michael Palladino, here quoted in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, saying many markets are seeing a point of saturation. New casinos are just cannibalizing the existing market. You mentioned Delaware, and of course, their revenues from casinos down 29% since fiscal 2011, cut 538 public jobs over the last 5 years, in part because of that decline. Chris is calling from Dover, Delaware. Hi, Chris. Thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you see with casinos there?
Well, we have two casinos. Our state is 92 miles long. Dover Downs Casino. They built a huge infrastructure thinking the growth would never stop. And then you had other states. Atlantic City's been in business for years with their casinos, plus they grew. And then you had the online gambling come into play. And now they're financially hurting. Open disclosure last year, the CEO out there said they only made $15,000, and the state of Delaware is being asked to relieve the two casinos we have in this state of $30 million of tax liability. And our state, like many other states in the country, is strapped and struggling. And, you know, we're not in a position, I don't think we're in a position to help them out like that. And to your point, they've lost lots of jobs. And I don't know what the answer to that is.
Well, Chris, I assume that when casinos were proposed for Delaware, it was described, it was promoted as a revenue boon, that it would be great for the state.
And it was for years a huge employer for the Kent County area, which is Dover, Delaware, and then about 30 miles south is the Harrington Casino. You know, the economy has hit us like everywhere else in the country, and unfortunately, they didn't have the foresight, in my opinion, to realize that these other states were going to see the huge boom that we were experiencing several years back, and they jumped on board and started building casinos, and then that business went away, especially in Maryland. You know, Maryland popped up with lots of situations there, new casinos, and then existing racetracks. There's a racetrack in the Ocean City, Maryland, a harness racing track that, you know, when the gambling came into Maryland, they were first on board, and they already had part of that infrastructure in place, building the parking lot, access off of the highways. So it really hurt.
It takes a lot to make it work, and when the revenues sag, that hurts too. And now, as you say, Delaware casinos asking for a break on those tax liabilities that were supposed to produce revenues for the state. Doug Walker, we've got a similar story in Maryland. You had Governor Martin O'Malley there in 2012 telling Marylanders that casinos would mean hundreds of millions of dollars for our schools as they were promoted there. And now that revenue share in trouble, more going to the casinos than to the schools now. That wasn't the plan, Doug.
Yeah, and it's going to, in Maryland, they're going to have two more casinos opening over the next couple of years, so it'll be interesting to see how that works. I think an interesting way to look at what's happening is to think of the industry as just another industry. So back in the 90s, when casinos first started to be legalized along the Mississippi, You had the situation which you mentioned in your introduction where it's attracting tourists. Now, the industry is so widespread that it's better to think of it not as some unique industry that draws in a bunch of tourism, but just like any other one. So just like the restaurant industry where you have to compete with additional businesses opening. And going back to Vin's earlier point, you know, the casinos are going to have to adapt to this. Instead of building huge properties like they have at Foxwoods, which is, you know, now with
Connecticut
casinos everywhere in the Northeast, that type of model probably won't work anymore. And so new casinos are going to have to kind of adapt to that and how they design them and in their size to the new increased competition that they face.
And Vin, if everybody's got them, I guess, to your point, they haven't competed well. What does that mean? They'll have to do more and heavier marketing for local gamblers to really bring out that crowd.
Well, it really depends on the casino, and I think Doug touched on something really important, which is they're now like every other business. They have to learn how to compete. So, yeah, they're gonna go after local customers, but they've been going after local customers for a long time. Going after local customers isn't new. You take a look at the Atlantic City market, going after local customers. Same thing in Pennsylvania. That's not new to it. The competition is.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about casinos and what kind of revenues they actually produce for states now that there are so many casinos in this country. Slot machines behind us right there from El Cortez Casino in Las Vegas. 39 states now have them. News today out of Massachusetts with the Supreme Judicial Court, that state's highest court, said this can go, will go, on the ballot in November for people, the Massachusetts residents, to decide if they want to go forward with casinos there. A lot of plans, but they could be all turned around. Vin Narayan is with us this hour, managing editor at the Casino City Times, joins us today from Washington. Doug Walker is with us from the College of Charleston, expert on the economic and social effects of casinos. We'll hear more in just a moment. Let's get our callers in Lowville, New York. Stephen, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What do you think?
Well, Tom, what I think is that has developed with these casinos is that I enjoy gambling a little bit. I love Las Vegas.
Yeah.
But the localized casinos, Las Vegas has people come in from all over the world. They have an infrastructure that supports financially the cab drivers, the hotels, and things like that. The local ones feed mostly on people of fixed incomes, people on welfare, people who are down on their luck, who want to maybe make it big. I see it at work all the time. I had just one of my coworkers blew her entire paycheck down and then goes back home, and it's only supporting that casino in itself. And I see it as a drain, because what happens is people lose their money and they either wind up having to be paid for by losing their job or something like that. And I'm very concerned by these local casinos.
Are you talking about in Vegas then, or in your own area, Stephen?
In my own area. We have several. We have one that's up in the northern part near Ogdensburg.
Yeah.
We have Turning Stone. We have Vernon Downs.
Plenty. And when you go, if you drop in, who do you see there, Stephen?
I see people that are with walkers. Busloads of senior citizens from the senior citizen homes. I see people that are taking out loans against their homes to pay for this. And, yes, that happens in Las Vegas. I'm not saying that that doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, the industry that exists in Las Vegas is set up. They go once a year. Okay, I blew maybe $200, but I had a great time. These people are blowing money, $200, $300, and I know of people that they don't have money to pay for food after that.
And this is again and again because it's local. Stephen, let me hold that thought, and I appreciate your call, and get one more right here. David in Rock Hill, South Carolina. David, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I was just going to point out some anecdotal observations of my wife and I. We both travel, and I've been through Tunica and observed that most of their clientele were elderly, retired. I mean, the great majority, as I walked through during the day and even in the evening. My wife saw the same thing when she had to travel up to the Northeast and some of the locals. So we've had this huge hit in the stock market. Their retirement accounts are still rebounding. So you've got a massive market that doesn't have money to gamble anymore. I think that's a big effect as well.
And that may be hitting it. You're talking about Tunica. You've got, of course, Harrah's Tunica Hotel and Casino in the northwestern Mississippi, in the Delta area there. And you, too, saw senior citizens coming out to play.
Yes, there's a ton of them. Many of them strapped to air oxygen tanks and just, you know, very feeble, but they're in there forking their money into those machines.
Wow. David, I appreciate your call as well. Vin Narayan, and this is not exactly the picture of casino life that we're shown when the big marketing push comes on television.
Well, no, and this is part of the paradigm shift in this country when it comes to casinos. Casinos, I mean, for a large part of the population now, casinos are a normal entertainment option. This isn't a thing that you go in and you do as a tourist. This is something that you consider among your many entertainment options, and you can go to the casino, you can go to the restaurant, you go to the movies. It's all part of the larger entertainment budget, and that's the way it is now. Casinos aren't a special thing that you go to visit. They're just something you do, and we've discovered, and it's something new. Everyone assumed that casinos were recession-proof. They're not. If you take a look at the last 5 to 6 years, you've seen discretionary spending go down as the economy took hits, and casino revenue took a hit as well. And so, yeah, there are people that are going to gamble, and there are locals that are going to gamble. It's one of their forms of entertainment. And are there people that gamble that shouldn't gamble and that can't afford to gamble? Yeah, there are. But it's also incumbent upon them to make the right financial decisions for themselves.
And good luck to them. Our caller's saying, you know, desperately trying to get back losses out of the stock market, or maybe don't have the money in the first place because there's payday loans out there. Barbara Defoe Whitehead joins us in just a moment. Let me get one more call from Milwaukee first. Lynn, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. I, you know, have gone to a local casino here. I won't say which one, but, you know, over the years they've paid out well, but they, as he said, they're not recession-proof. And what I find is they pull back on their payouts, okay, as they get into trouble. And then people don't want to come. You know, the word is out. Oh, they're not paying. People don't go. And then it ends up being, like the other caller said, just the people who go are desperate. So it ends up being a drain. So any supposed money, this revenue is supposed to be for schools, I don't know, especially when times get hard, if it's balancing out. And they're already complaining, oh, you know, we need more help. I mean, they're taking money, needing more tax money, complaining about the money and not paying out money, and taking money from people who don't have money.
And when you go to the local casino, well, who do you see there, Lynn? Who comes out?
I tell you, just like that man said, I'm sorry, if you see old people, poor people, desperate people. I mean, it's sad, and it's not helping the community like they said it would, and they're not, and they are pulling back on their payout. So why go? Why am I going to go if I spend 2 hours and spend $200, I can't even win 10? That's ridiculous.
Not exactly a sizzling, sexy scene you're describing there, but Lynn, I appreciate your call from Milwaukee very much. Barbara Defoe Whitehead joins us right now from Amherst, Massachusetts, director of the Center for Thrift and Generosity at the Institute for American Values. It's a think tank based out of New York on family and social issues. Barbara Defoe Whitehead, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
We read your essay over the weekend in the New York Times headlined Gaming the Poor. And before we can even get to you, our listeners are calling in and pretty much describing what you wrote about in the Times. Tell us what you've witnessed there in casino land.
Well, I think several of the callers were right on point. Casinos, the glut I'm concerned about where the glut is headed. And the saturation problem is not so dire for casinos. I'm not really shedding a tear for them because they're very good at making money. What I do find troubling is that the saturation effect is hitting people in the lower part of the income distribution.
When you say saturation, what do you mean exactly, Barbara?
I mean that more and more people have a casino, as you said, within a short bus trip or drive from where they
mm-hmm,
live.
Mm-hmm.
And so casinos, as another one of the experts says, has become a routine part of daily life. But it also exacts a cost on the people who are playing. And they are increasingly people from the lower part of the income ladder. So, you know, it used to be that proponents of casinos would say, well, we want to have a casino in our state because another state gets the money, but the problems land in our state. But now the problems are going to be mounting in the states that are increasingly adding more and more casinos within their borders.
You write, as casinos have spread into deindustrialized cities, dying resorts, and gritty urban areas, the rate of gambling participation has grown among lower-income groups. Is that clear, Barbara? Are the numbers on that?
Well, of course, if you really want the numbers, you should go to the casinos themselves, because they do keep massive amount of data on who their customers are and what the best way to market to them is. But there are a few studies that do suggest that people who have ready geographic access to casinos gamble more, and they gamble more frequently. And I think the casinos know that, and they market to that. So they do try to get repeat customers rather than, you know, somebody who drops in once a year.
You cite a study out of University at Buffalo and SUNY Buffalo saying if you live within 10 miles of one or more casinos, it more than doubles the rate of problems from excessive gambling. But among lower-income gamblers, where's the money come from? Why would casinos target people who don't really have money, Barbara?
Well, I argue in the piece that casinos are joining payday lenders, subprime credit card lenders, and others who are very good at milking money from people at the lower end of the income ladder. So, you know, you can make profits over from people who are not fabulously rich.
How do you do that if you're a casino and you're targeting that demographic that doesn't have a lot of money? How do you make money?
Two things. One is the technology. These casinos are basically big slot parlors. They have very sophisticated technology, namely the slot machine, that can regulate the style of play, the duration of play, the sound ambience, for even so little as a penny per bet on multiple lines of the electronic device. And so people play for a long time with small amounts. They win some, they lose more, and they come back again. And that's the way that you can get milk money from people who become your regulars in lower income areas of the country.
You say casinos are gathering information on customers to predict their lifetime value to the casino so they can project even from a low income patron.
Yes, and there are lots of stories about how they do that. They offer free food. They offer extra play, free play. They make the environment very welcoming to elderly people who find it a safe and comfortable way to spend while away an afternoon. And then they, through the machines, regulate the amount of money people lose over a period of time, always enticing them to come back. Well, like, oh, you almost won. Come back again. Here, $10 worth of free play, and visit us again soon through direct mail, through all kinds of marketing mechanisms.
Vin Narayan, can we talk about that technology for a second? I must be very naive, but I had assumed that slot machines kind of had a regular random mechanism and that the odds were pretty well fixed. But here's Barbara writing about software in the slot machines now being very nuanced, kind of playing the psychology of slot players. Is it that manipulable, how the slot machine's going to interact with players?
Not really. It's not that manipulable. Well, basically, what happens is slot machines, and each slot machine is different, has a range of outcomes and a range of what we call holds. How much money is the casino going to hold? And they range from 89 to 95%, somewhere in those range. And some parts of the country, you'll get lower ranges. And other parts of the country, you'll get higher ranges. But the consumer is going to get 80, 90, 95% of the money back. So the casino is actually holding 5%. Is a consumer going to lose over the long run? Yes, that's the house edge that the casino's built in. But you know that going in. It's an 89 to 95. They're not changing the machine on a daily basis. They're not changing the machine on an hourly basis. They're not doing any of that stuff. The machines stay the same. The payouts stay the same. And each game has a slightly different payout. But the consumer's going to keep about 89, between 89 and 95% of their money when they're are going over the course of time. That means over the course of time, they're losing 5%. Now, there are variances in that. There are some sessions you're going to sit down and you're going to lose all the money you brought with to game. And then there are others that you're going to win some, because that's sort of the variation of chance. And the 89 to 95% over a large sample size. But it's not that finely tuned. What the casinos are really good at, though, that Barbara mentioned, is they're really good at collecting information on their data, marketing to that data set, and they're really good at providing a really good customer experience. So when someone goes, it doesn't matter whether you're elderly in your 40s, the whole point of going to a casino is having a good time. And they make sure you have a good time when you go to that. And casinos don't – the other two things that are really important to consider is casinos in these communities generate lots and lots of jobs. And they pay out lots of money into the state coffers. And on the balance, they do a whole lot more good than harm. That's the first thing. And then the second thing to remember is casinos don't make any money by targeting people who have no money. That's not where their profits come from. Their profits come from going after people with discretionary income, marketing to those people, and they're really good at identifying those people and marketing to them.
Barbara, they do a whole lot more good than harm, and they don't target people without money.
Well, they're located in areas where people with low incomes or people on fixed incomes, as anybody who's walked into one of these local casinos will tell you, there are people in walkers, retirees, people who are out of work, who are financially desperate. And yes, they have some pennies in their pocket. They get Social Security checks, by the way, the casinos know when Social Security checks arrive in people's bank accounts. So I think it's a little bit incorrect to suggest that that these aren't cleverly designed marketing programs that do exploit, if you want to say that, people in the lower income and fixed income population.
Doug Walker, how do you look at it now with the, I don't know if saturation is the right word, but in some areas it's certainly getting there, that's asserted. How do you look at the on balance economically in terms of social effects, casinos doing a whole lot more good than harm? Do you agree, Doug?
In general, yeah, I would say that I would think that the economic benefits probably outweigh the costs. And there's a few things that go into that. One is, as Vin mentioned, the jobs effect. There's been county-level studies done over the U.S. that show that counties with casinos see an increase in employment relative to those without, and also a positive, slightly positive wage effect. So those types of economic effects, of course, the tax revenues, which seem to be the main policy issue. And then on the other side of it, you have social costs, which we may get into a little bit more. But the other thing that's missing usually in the debate is the effect on consumers. So people... And there may be some people, obviously, that have gambling problems. There's others that you might argue that should not be at the casino because they can't afford it. But the great majority of the people that are at the casino are people that see it as entertainment, and that's how they chose to spend their money for that evening. And so you have to think that they're getting some benefit for that. And that's something that's hard to quantify, the entertainment value, but that's something that I think is missing. And when you include that in the kind of cost-benefit discussion, I would argue that the benefits probably still outweigh the costs.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking about casinos and what kind of revenues they actually produce for states now that there are so many casinos in this country. 39 states with casinos in are coming in. Massachusetts today, the high court there decided they will have a chance to reconsider the green light for casinos in a referendum in November. Very much in the news in lots of communities where there are so many now that people are talking saturation. You've got communities where casinos are asking for breaks on the revenues, that the split that they had promised to the state, because it's just not producing as anticipated. Doug Walker is with us, a professor of economics at the College of Charleston in South Carolina, expert on the economic and social effects of casinos. Vin Narayanan is with us, managing editor at Casino City Times. Barbara Defoe Whitehead is here from the Thrift and Generosity, director at the Center for Thrift and Generosity, the Institute for American Values, joins us today from Amherst, Massachusetts. And we have so many callers. Laura in Ashtabula, Ohio. Laura, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I haven't heard, I don't think, mention of the casino buses and the senior citizen discounts on buses that bring senior citizens and anybody who wants to the casinos. I'm speaking specifically about between and within Ohio and Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And I was surprised in the Erie, Pennsylvania casino to find the smoking section, which might also be a topic of conversation.
But Laura, so it's free buses for senior citizens. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Our guests are describing it as
free,
entertainment. So
a discount.
yeah. So is that a good thing because it helps people go out and be entertained?
Well, I'm not real sure, to be honest. I've been on the buses where, you know, and I'm not a senior citizen myself, and these folks are all real nice and friendly, and they definitely are going for entertainment. But I wouldn't say that 100% of them are, spending money that might not be better spent for them elsewhere.
Yeah.
Not that I want to make that choice on their behalf, but, you know.
But in the end, many states do make it when we decide whether or not to bring in casinos and gambling. Laura, thanks for the call from Ashtabula. One more right here from Arlington, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. My son's mother, who had a very high position at an elite university, got addicted to gambling. Now, they gave her incredible perks. I mean, they were just fabulous. And I won't go into the detail of them, but they were really impressive. You also had a program on some time ago that went into the detail of how people get addicted to the casino gambling. And why I specify casinos is because the program went in depth on how they work. And one of the things they did was, even when people went bankrupt and could no longer gamble on credit, the casinos would actually call them, offer them perks, and say, we really want you to come back, and we'll give you this little perk instead. The second really interesting thing was that the research showed that when there's a near miss on slot machines, the gambler, especially the problem gambler, gets the same endorphin rush as they get when they actually hit. And that's why when you pull that lever, there's a lot, or push the button, there's a lot of near misses.
There's a lot going on. Michael, I appreciate your call. Barbara, you write about this, that the slot machine software is actually programmed now to create near misses, because I think you're sort of saying exactly what Michael's saying there, that the buzz from a near miss is very potent.
It is, and brain scientists have written about this, and some of them even work for casino companies in order to maximize sort of the psychological value of, talk about entertainment, the kind of creating a kind of zone where people just keep pushing the button and pushing the button because it's mesmerizing. And as I said, these are very sophisticated programs. I don't agree that they're just, random number generators. They are designed to encourage sort of duration of play, time on device, it's called, so that people keep loading their cards full of money to keep having that pleasurable sensation.
Vin, here's a comment from one of our listeners. I mean, you call it entertainment, but our listener Yar says they really are simply drug delivery systems, a complex system of neurotransmitters, serotonin, dopamine, endogenous opioids, hormones, all responsible for what we feel, how we think, what we do. Calling casinos kind of, endorphin delivers. I suppose you could say, well, lots of entertainment is. The World Cup is, I guess you might say, Vin.
The World Cup, look, all forms of entertainment are endorphin delivers. And I feel terrible for the caller's mother. I do. And I sympathize. And problem gambling is a serious problem that shouldn't be ignored in all of this. the question becomes, all right, you have 95% of the public that can play without having an issue, and you've got 5% that can't. And how do you balance the two? I think that problem gambling program should be fully funded. I think the casino should be contributed heavily to that. I think legislature should demand a fully funded problem gambling program. They should follow the steps and the guidelines from the National Council of Problem Gambling, and they should take that seriously. I'm not saying you don't take it seriously. I'm just saying that it has to be weighed in the fine balance of things, and understand that that isn't the experience for most people. The experience for most people is they go, they have a fun time, they eat a meal, they have a drink, and then they go back home.
Doug, here's a listener, Levy Girl, writes and says, yuck, whoever thinks that casino is a decent business is crazy. The only good it does is filling up pockets of execs, turns neighborhoods into dumps, and ruins people's lives. Jobs opportunities? Cannot think of a worse place to work than a casino. What do you say, Doug?
Well, that person may have that perception of casinos, but the people that work there, I'm sure, appreciate the jobs that they have. Typically, the local area has to voters in that area approve to have the casino. So obviously, there's no doubt that some people dislike casinos, and most people might say that they don't want to have them in their own backyard. But that's the good thing about the system we have, where at the state level, people can make that decision. And Massachusetts is going to have that opportunity again to either decide to go through with it or not. But, you know, different people have different perspectives on it.
How do you see revenues holding up over time here? Well, again, Wall Street Journal talking this week about the Northeastern market, for one, reaching a saturation point. There have been projections done over the years. Do you think they hold up, Doug, if that point is being reached?
Well, I think you're likely to see some moderation in tax rates. So you've mentioned Delaware a few times. And in Delaware and New York at the racetracks, I think the tax rate on the casino revenues is around 67%. In Pennsylvania, it's over 50%, while in some other states like Nevada and New Jersey, it's relatively low, around 7 to 9%. And I think as the industry spreads and becomes more competitive, states also are going to probably have to start considering moderating the tax rates.
In other words, they won't take as big a bite at the casino overall gross, because the casinos will argue, what, there's too much competition, we can't afford it.
Yeah, I think that's what you're likely to start seeing. And I think, you know, Delaware is the first one of the first indications of that.
At what point does it not deliver on the promise then for a particular region if you start cutting those tax rates on casino revenues?
Well, if you want to keep the industry competitive, that's the trade-off. If you want to keep the tax rates high, you can, but you might start seeing individual casinos close up. And if you want to allow them to remain more competitive as they are in neighboring states, then they might have to start lowering the tax rate. That's a decision that, you know, each state is going to have to face.
But Barbara, isn't that tax take part of the reason that many states approve them in the first place? Not to imagine that they'll become industries that need special support, but they've been described as real revenue generators for the state, and that's part of the reason they get the green light.
Well, that's how they've been sold to the public. But when the reality dawns on people, public opinion changes. And it is changing in Massachusetts particularly. People are very disenchanted with what casinos bring to a community over the long haul. And I think actually your callers seem to reflect that. People are sold casinos as a great boon for jobs and a great revenue producer for the state. But they do not deliver on that promise. And with saturation, there will be more disenchantment with the effects of casinos on the society, on the revenue that states are able to gain. And the only business that will be happy here are the casinos, because they can always move on to the internet and make money there.
John in Ponca City, Oklahoma. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is John.
Hey.
I used to work at a casino, and you wouldn't believe it, all the people that would come in and out of the casino and then want refunds or stuff like that because they've lost all their money. There's one guy in particular, he lost his kid's Christmas money one Christmas. And, you know, we tried to tell him to slow down, and he just wouldn't listen.
I mean, it happens, but what about the argument that it's entertainment? Even if people lose some money, a lot of people get entertained, John.
Yeah, I mean, they're entertainment, but that's what it's there for. I think it's, but still, people abuse it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, no, of course, that definitely happens. I mean, that's part of what any society has to weigh when they invite it in. Yet we invite it in. Let me go to Dan, if I may, in Upton, Kentucky. Dan, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Yes.
My question, to steal your phrase, is at what point? Just like amusement parks have, you must be so tall to ride this ride, you have to be so old to buy alcohol or tobacco. At what point do we become responsible for an individual's choices? It's a venue. I receive advertisements for appliances, magazines, cruises. I choose to spend my money or not. At what point does it become the public's responsibility to say, you don't make enough money to go here? It's a person's responsibility.
I mean, you think it's an individual responsibility, but you know, of course, for centuries, this country did not embrace gambling as a legal activity. I guess people thought there was a reason for that, Dan. Do you think that whatever that was, that it no longer applies?
I don't think it no longer applies. I think it's a phase that we go through. We had prohibition on alcohol. We've got the war on drugs. We don't like gambling. Things come and go.
Things come and go. Dan, I appreciate your call. And one more, Abilene, Texas. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a comment that that my wife and I, we go to casinos, but we usually get perks, like free nights at their hotels. We get bonus free play cash, free meals and such. And it's all marketing, but you also have to go into it thinking, I have this amount of money. This is what I want to do with it. So when I'm done, I'm done.
And when you look around, Jeff, do you see people being generally pretty good at that?
In some cases, but I see other people, too, that just kind of sit there and they're, you know, they yell at the machine and, you know, and so on and so forth. But it's generally, you know, in cases where you see people who you know are getting the perks and the stuff like that, they more or less are like, yes, I have this amount of money. This is what I have budgeted for this, and that's what I'm going to do. And when I'm done, I'm done.
Jeff, it sounds like you're pretty level-headed about it there coming out of Abilene. Barbara, here's a listener online writes, Chuck says, casinos equal a tax on the poor who are hoping to magically make it rich. You've looked at this in the context of inequality in this country and how it plays into that scene. What do you see there, Barbara?
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, increasingly, we have a two-tier economy with people in the upper tier having all kinds of good advantages to gain wealth, invest, make money. And then we have a fast-growing bottom tier. And it really preys on the financially down, desperate people, people who are out of work, who cannot dream of ever getting ahead in their lives. So for them, the opportunity to gamble provides an alternative way to fulfill a dream that probably, almost certainly, will not be fulfilled through gambling. So that there is this bigger kind of structural context in which we have to understand the spread of casino gambling. It is increasingly part of this lower tier economy.
Doug Walker, is it a one-way street? 39 states have said, come on in. Once a state does that, has anybody turned around and said, no? Is it politically possible once casinos are in to wave them goodbye, even if you've got like Tunica with its miracle souring or the big casino going bankrupt in Atlantic City? Can it be turned around, Doug, once it's in, practically speaking?
Well, it's yet to be seen. Massachusetts might do something close, depending on the vote later this year.
Though they're not in here. I mean, they're still on the drawing board in Massachusetts.
South Carolina actually had video lottery terminals basically slot machines, but not at casinos, at bars and restaurants, and they banned those back in 2000. So that's one case where it's a little bit easier to do that in the sense that you don't have huge casinos that have been built to house the machines. But I think it would be politically difficult for a state. I would be very surprised if a state were to do that to at one point.
And what makes it difficult? Is it the jobs that are there or the connections with politicians in the state? What creates the friction about turning it around?
Well, as long as there's revenue coming into the state, politicians, are going to have a hard time saying, okay, we're going to ban this industry.
Even if it's not what was expected.
Well, it's still a source of revenue to them. It might not be as much as they were hoping for, but you still have a situation where it's a relatively easy source of revenue for them. Politicians control the industry, how much it can expand and all of that. And if they don't have that revenue, they have to come up with it from some other means, through income taxes or sales taxes, which are probably politically more difficult to increase.
Charges in hard to push the other way if it should come to that. And a lot of states now looking at the population of casinos grow around them. Fascinating. Doug Walker at the College of Charleston in Charleston, South Carolina. We appreciate your insights today, Doug. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Vin Narayanan, managing editor at the Casino City Times, with us today from Washington. Vin, thank you for your insights.
Thanks for having me.
And Barbara Defoe Whitehead at the New York-based Institute for American Values. Barbara, thanks for your essay and thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Barbara Defoe Whitehead, author of Franklin's Thrift, The History of a Lost American Virtue. Listeners, thanks for joining us. Good luck one way or another. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.